and welcome to Speaking with Joy, a podcast about books, beauty, and music. So make yourself a cup of tea, sit down, and let's begin. Because children have abounding vitality, because they are in spirit fierce and free, therefore they want things repeated and unchanged. They always say, "Do it again!" And the grown-up person does it again until he is nearly dead. For grown-up people are not strong enough to exult in monotony. But perhaps God is strong enough to exult in monotony. It is possible that God says every morning, "Do it again," to the sun, and every evening, "Do it again," to the moon. It may be automatic necessity that makes all daisies alike, but it may be that God makes every daisy separately, but has never got tired of making them. It may be that he has the eternal appetite of infancy. For we have sinned and grown old, but our Father is younger than we. Well, hello, friends, and welcome back to Speaking with Joy. This is our third episode in the autumnal season, and it is all about the wisdom of whimsy. Now, I must confess that I'm a bit nervous that I will fall into my usual pitfall, because I have been stewing over this episode for weeks because it's something that I am really passionate about. And when I was at Oxford, I always found that the things that I was the most passionate about, I had the most difficult time writing about, and some of my favorite books were the ones that I wrote the worst papers on. So, time will tell if I do a good job on this podcast, and you'll have to let me know what you think about it. But before we dive into this week's podcast, let me give you a few reminders and updates. The first update is an exciting announcement. Speaking with Joy has been adopted as one of the Anselm Society's featured podcasts. Now, the Anselm Society is an organization that operates in the Rocky Mountains, whose purpose is to renew the Christian imagination. So they work with churches to ask questions about the arts and how we can incorporate more thoughtfully how we think about the arts and the church. And my podcast has been adopted as one of three other podcasts. They have one podcast with artists, one podcast about art, which is mine, and then one podcast where they talk about kind of art and the church. So go check them out at Anselm Society, and I'm delighted to be one of their featured podcasts. The second thing I wanted to tell you all is that it is so helpful to me, if you enjoy this podcast, that you rate, subscribe, and review it on iTunes. And also, I would love to see you follow and interact with me on Twitter, Instagram, or Facebook. I love to be able to see your comments and know what you think about it. And also, those are good spaces where you can interact with other people who are enjoying the podcast and discuss things or ask questions. So if you're interested in that, go follow me on those platforms. It's always just Joy Clarkson or Join Us the Brave. And I would also encourage anyone who wants to engage with the topics that I'm talking about in the podcast more deeply to check out my Patreon. That's just patreon.com/Joy Clarkson. The Patreon is really a way for people who enjoy the podcast to engage with it more deeply. Every month you'll get a newsletter which will have something true, something good, and something beautiful. And it also has discussion questions for all of the podcasts. So I kind of like to think about perhaps that would be a way for you to think about it, or you could have a friend over and talk through it, because I love the idea of this podcast bringing other people together. You'll also get a special podcast that nobody else will get to hear, a secret podcast as a thank you for supporting me. And that's the other thing with the Patreon, is that many of you know that I am a PhD student, and having your support while I do my PhD means that I still have the time to be able to do the podcast, and it basically just helps with my ordinary life costs, puts coffee in my cup and books on my shelves. And truly, while I am invested in doing this work, it means a lot to me to have your support. So I would encourage you to check out the Patreon if you want to get a little more out of the podcast and you also wouldn't mind helping support me. So with all of that aside, today we're going to dive into our topic, which is the wisdom of whimsy. Now to begin today, I want to start by telling you a story. I'm sure it comes as no surprise to most of you that in my undergraduate years, I was very busy. I was an RA, I did debate, I never slept and was always doing something. And one of the many things that I did was that I worked on a magazine staff. And during that time, at one point, I had discovered all of this really interesting information about Beatrix Potter, we're going to talk about today, and I proposed it as just kind of a little special interest story to one of the editors. And I said, you know, she's this really remarkable woman. She did all of these beautiful illustrations for children. And I just find her really interesting. And she was a wonderful businesswoman. And I told one of the editors. And he wrote back to me with a surprisingly vehement response and said, her art is whimsical and useless, and it doesn't mean anything. We live in a difficult world, and this kind of art just gives people unrealistic expectations. Now, I was rather gobsmacked because, for one thing, I did not expect someone to have that strong feelings about a children's book illustrator. I mean, I have very strong feelings about children's books, but that's because I love them. I didn't expect someone to vehemently hate them. So this brought up two responses in me. First, I wanted to just throw it out and reject it because it seemed so ridiculous to hate something lovely so vehemently. But then the other side of me wanted to give a profound or a more full answer to the question of whether or not this art was bad, or if it was bad for us, if it made us unable to handle the rest of the world. So I started a blog draft called In Defense of Whimsy, and that's about as much as I thought about it, until I came upon an article last year. Now, this article was by someone who is very well respected, someone who I respect very much in the realm of theology and the arts, but something about it rang untrue to me. So in the article, he said that all good art must represent the triduum. Now, if you don't know what the triduum is, that means the 3 days. So it represents the 3 days of Christ's death and resurrection. So he said all good art, particularly all Christian art, should represent the death of Good Friday, that there's chaos and disorder and disruption in the world, the silence of Good Saturday, that often we experience the silence of God, and the resurrection of Sunday. And he said, if something doesn't represent that to us, if it just focuses on nice things that make us feel good, he used the example of William Bouguereau, who does these beautiful kind of sentimental paintings, he said it'll make us soft. Essentially, his argument was kind of a moral one. He said that whimsical art, things that are kind of just playful or funny or just enjoy the pretty things of life, is ultimately bad art because it doesn't represent reality, because to him, reality is the triduum. It's the death, the silence, and the resurrection. But also this sort of art is not only bad art, but that it's bad for us, that it makes us unable to handle the realities of the world. It kind of makes us soft and naive. Now, on the one hand, I understand where he was coming from. One of the main criticisms of cheesy Christian films is that they always have these very predictable plots in which they end very happily and all the questions are answered and the prayers are answered and the marriage works out. And the reality is that a lot of life isn't like that. And so if we always watch films like that, then it won't prepare us for how to deal with reality. Part of the role of art surely is to help us reckon with the darkness and find hope nonetheless. But to say that all art has to deal with the death and the silence and the resurrection rang hollow to me. What do you do with art that is not necessarily magnificent or art that is not necessarily dark? Is that bad art? Is it bad for us? What do we do with whimsy? Now, I think it's important to pause here and define what I mean by this word. The Cambridge Dictionary defines whimsy as unusual, funny, and pleasant ideas or qualities. Or, more negatively, something that is intended to be strange and humorous, but in fact has very little real meaning or value. I think it's funny to note that there's already a negativity even in the definition of whimsy. But as I've thought about it, I think that there is a place for whimsical art, and in fact, an important place for whimsical art. I've come to believe that whimsy helps us recognize the intrinsic goodness of life, and that that recognition energizes us to protect that goodness. I think that whimsical art actually does represent something in reality. It can be good art, and, perhaps more importantly, it can be good art for us. And that is the idea that we're going to wrestle with and investigate today. And we'll be doing that by looking at three artists who were whimsical and were also great defenders of goodness. The first we'll be looking at is G.K. Chesterton and his novel Man Alive, which is delightful and strange and absurd and whimsical. Then we'll be looking at Beatrix Potter and the way that her whimsical art led her also to defend the Lake District. And then finally, we'll be looking at one of my all-time favorite musical artists, Regina Spektor. So friends, without further ado, let us discover why whimsy is wise. Good Gilbert Keith Chesterton was born in 1874 to a loving, creative, and agnostic family. He had a surprisingly lovely childhood for someone growing up in the late Edwardian era. His parents were fairly progressive, and they had strange views about education, so he got to read and paint and cultivate his creative abilities, something that would come in handy the rest of his life, but particularly for when he was a young man and he decided to go to the London Slade School of Art. However, it was there that he had a mental breakdown. Now, in Orthodoxy, he writes about this sort of vaguely, but he describes himself as becoming morbid. More or less, what he means by this is that he kind of became suicidal, and that this bloomed out of this sense of meaninglessness, of kind of existential nausea, and this place where he began to wonder, does life mean anything? Is it worth living? And is there a way to know if it means anything? Now, rushing forward in the story over years and years, he came to think that the answer to many of those questions lay in becoming a Christian, and he credits his wife, Frances, his lovely wife, with being the one who brought him back around to that, and then later on in his life, he became Catholic. But it's interesting because G.K. Chesterton became one of the most vociferous advocates and apologists for Christianity, even though he came from this very non-religious background. And one of the things he was famous for was being the Prince of Paradox. He was a merry debater. He loved to laugh, and he was hearty. He was also very strange. He was 6'4" and nearly 300 pounds, so he was kind of a comical figure, even just as a person. But his apologetics were known for being funny and delightful and lighthearted, and he was a friendly enemy with George Bernard Shaw, who, of course, was the famous atheist. But Chesterton, who came from this place of having been nearly suicidal, and struggling with that for a year and causing him to drop out of the art school, he moved from that place to this place of humor, of paradox, and of whimsy. And this presents us with a question. Did he just deny the pain that he felt? Was all his humor and jocularity simply a rejection of the reality that he experienced in his moments of depression and sadness? Or was something else at play? And I think the answer boils down to this. For Chesterton, whimsy was not a way to cover up the stark realities of life, but rather it was a tool to help us truly recognize the wonder and strangeness of existence. Probably the best place to find his philosophy of whimsy would be in his intellectual biography, Orthodoxy. Now, he wrote this because he was famous for loving to kind of playfully take down other people's arguments. And someone had said, Chesterton, you can't just go around tearing down everyone else's arguments for what they believe without saying what you believe. And so he wrote this book, Orthodoxy, as kind of an intellectual biography of his own life. It wasn't so much a defense of Christianity as it was kind of a tale of how he came to believe it was true. And in it, what he says is that one of our main issues is not so much that we have difficulty discerning what is true about reality, but that we have lost our ability to experience reality fully. And Chesterton thinks that we won't be able to come to any sort of true opinions about the world until we truly reckon with it. There's this excellent chapter, I think it's called On Fairyland or something like that, or something about the nursery and fairy tales. Anyway, where he talks about how life is much more like a fairy tale than we give it credit for. So in a fairy tale, you have all these kind of rules that you just have to accept to live in the world of the fairy tale as you're reading it. So, you know, a witch might say, if you don't get the golden apple back to the flowering tree by midnight, you'll turn into a frog. And the whole point of a fairy tale is that you just have to believe it because that's the stakes of the story you're giving you. And he says that life is really much more like this than we give it credit for. There's kind of this givenness to life that we sometimes lose the awareness of. Chesterton says we take it for granted that we have, you know, 10 toes and 10 fingers. And we take it for granted that we live on this little spinning orb in the middle of space. And the beginning of finding truth, of finding something real, is reckoning with the strangeness of reality. He has this wonderful quote where he says, fairy tales say that apples were golden only to refresh the forgotten moment when we found that they were green. They make rivers run with wine only to make us remember, for one wild moment, that they run with water. And so for Chesterton, whimsy is this way of kind of reorienting us to the strangeness of the world. And that's where all of his philosophy begins. It begins with kind of reckoning with the world as this strange place that is given to us in a particular way, and that we have to kind of accept and then reckon with. I wrote my friend Bose Harrington, who is a delightful tweeter. He's the library haunter. If you want to go on Twitter, I would stay on Twitter if only to read his tweets. And I was writing him about this, and he wrote this to me. And just as a preface, Chesterton loved Lewis Carroll and Alice in Wonderland exactly for this reason, because he said that it helped you kind of reckon with the strangeness and wonder of the world. And so this is what Bo said. I've been rereading the introduction to the annotated Alice, where he talks about Carroll's effect on Chesterton and how, seen from one way, the world is a nightmare, and seen from another way, the world is a miracle, and how nonsense literature captures the strangeness of the world like nothing else does. So for Chesterton, whimsy, absurdism, the strangeness of his stories and the humor was not a way to escape reality, it was a way to re-engage with it. It's kind of like if you were a kid and you ever used to gaze upside down, if you'd hang upside down in your bed or your chair, and you'd look at the whole world and it was strange and odd and you suddenly realized how remarkable everything was. Then when you turned back right ways up, you began to reckon with the world as it truly was, in all of its strangeness and wonder and givenness. Now, I think perhaps the best example of Chesterton putting this idea to work is in his novel Man Alive. Now, if you'll recall our definition of whimsy being something which is playfully quaint or fanciful or odd or humorous, I think that this book falls perfectly into those categories. So let me tell you a bit about Man Alive and the Adventures of Innocent Smith. Now, the book opens in this, I believe it's a boarding house in London, with all these sort of boring, cynical people. And then in comes this character called Innocent Smith. He's kind of larger than life and interesting and strange, and he makes them all play games, and he says ridiculous and wondrous things. And it's funny because he comes floating in literally like Mary Poppins, so he kind of appears out of the sky, out of the stormy, windy day. And his effect on this household is miraculous. People start to fall in love. People who were enemies become reconciled. There's this sense of a coming alive because Innocent Smith has come. And he brings with him this strangeness, this whimsy, this delight, this humor. But to their great surprise, halfway through the book, policemen appear and say that Innocent Smith is wanted on several counts. He is said to be a burglar, a murderer, an attempted murderer, and an adulterer. And everyone is shocked by this revelation. He seems like this innocent, wonderful person, and so he's put on trial. And I'm kind of giving away the plot to you, but it's not exactly a plot-driven book, so go read it anyway. And if you want to, you can, skip the next 30 seconds. But what comes to be the case is that Innocent Smith stole all his own possessions so that he might know how much they were truly worth. And Innocent Smith put a gun to someone's head so that for one wild moment the man would know how much he really wanted to be alive. And he would leave his wife and then plant her in various hotels and restaurants and countries around the world just so he could have the pleasure of falling in love with her all over again. So this book is absolutely strange and absurd, but it shows this idea of when you turn things on their head, sometimes you're suddenly able to appreciate them in their fullness for the first time. And I think that this section, this quote from Man Alive, really sums up the gospel of Innocent Smith. He says, "His principle can be quite simply stated. He refuses to die while he is still alive. He seeks to remind himself by every electric shock to the intellect that he is still a man alive, walking on two legs about the world. For this reason, he fires bullets at his best friends. For this reason, he arranges ladders and collapsible chimneys to steal his own property. For this reason, he goes on plotting a whole planet to get back to his own home. And for this reason, he has been in the habit of taking the woman whom he loved with a permanent loyalty and leaving her about, so to speak, at schools, boarding houses, and places of business, so that he might recover her again and again, with a raid and a romantic elopement. He seriously sought, by a perpetual recapture of his bride, to keep alive the sense of her perpetual value and the perils that should be run for her sake." So Innocent Smith is this picture of whimsy, of the world turned on its head, so that when it's turned back right again, you begin to see the wonder and the beauty of ordinary things. You begin to truly be able to reckon with reality as it is. And Chesterton says this is the only place that we can actually truly begin to construct a view of reality, is when we encounter it as strange and as given. Now you may say this is all very nice, but what role does this have in actual living? What impact does it have on the way we live our lives? And this is what comes to the second part of what I claim to begin with, which is that whimsy not only is good art because it helps us reckon with reality, but it is also good for us because as we begin to treasure the world and all of its strangeness and wonder on its small and microscopic levels, we begin to want to be the defenders of it. Whimsy helped Chesterton know the true value of ordinary things, and knowing this emboldened him to be a bold defender of what was good in the world. Now, something else that's interesting about Chesterton is that he was known to be something of a political radical. Some people called him a Christian socialist, but at the same time he wrote against socialism. Whatever his views were, he had this vision of the world and how we ought to protect the good at all costs. But this strange and radical politics came out of his love of the wondrousness of the world. And that shaped what he believed about it and how he believed that politics ought to be drawn out, no matter what you believe about his politics. And I think a really good example of this is there's a section from something called What's Wrong with the World by Chesterton, where he does the same kind of whimsical focusing in on the strangeness, on the details, on the humor and wondrousness, turning things upside down so that you can see them right side up, and build a political vision off of that. So let me read you this. I begin with a little girl's hair. That, I know, is a good thing at any rate. Whatever else is evil, the pride of a good mother and the beauty of her daughter is good. It is one of the most adamantine tendernesses, which are the touchstones of every age and race. If other things were against it, other things must go down. If landlords and laws and sciences are against it, landlords and laws and sciences must go down. With the red hair of one she-urchin in the gutter, I will set fire to all of modern civilization. Because a girl should have long hair, she should have clean hair. Because she should have clean hair, she should not have an unclean home. Because she should not have an unclean home, she should have a free and leisured mother. Because she should have a free mother, she should not have a usurious landlord. Because there should not be a usurious landlord, there should be a redistribution of property. Because there should be a redistribution of property, there shall be a revolution. That little urchin with the gold-red hair, whom I have just watched toddling past my house, she shall not be lopped and lamed and altered. Her hair shall not be cut short like a convict's. No, the kingdoms of the earth shall be hacked about and mutilated to suit her. She is the human and sacred image. All around her the social fabric shall sway and split and fall. The pillars of society shall be shaken, and the roofs of the ages shall come rushing down. Not one hair of her head shall be harmed. I think this passage is so powerful, and it's powerful because what Chesterton is doing is he's saying that whatever views we hold of the world, whatever politics we want to support, it has to begin with a vision of the good. And with that vision firmly fixed in our minds, we can begin to move forward with our philosophic or theological or political convictions based on a view of what life should be, not just what we've allowed it to be because we've given in to cynicism. And to me, I think that is the heart of why whimsy is not only good art, or at least it can be good art, but also why it is good for us. Because what Chesterton does is that he depicts the wondrousness, the strangeness, the intrinsic goodness of the world by turning the world on its head so that we can see it right way up. But in doing that, he teaches us to love the goodness of the world so that we become defenders and protectors of it. When we are attuned to the goodness and tenderness of the world, evil becomes repugnant to us, and we know to reject it. Whimsy's wisdom is that it helps us to recognize the intrinsic goodness of life, and it energizes us to protect that goodness. Whimsical art can be good art simply because it helps us see the world as it truly is, wondrous and strange, both a dream and a nightmare. But it's also good art for us, because it encourages us to go out and protect what is good, what is small, what is innocent. And no protection is truly complete if it doesn't begin with that vision of the good. With this defense of whimsy in mind, let us look to another artist who had a whimsical streak herself and enjoyed the small and strange, and whose love of the small and strange energized her to protect and preserve England's most beautiful landscape, the Lake District. Beatrix Potter, born in 1866, was the author and illustrator of the well-beloved children's book, The Tale of Peter Rabbit. But there's much more to this illustrator of the bunny books than meets the eye. She was a talented artist, to be sure, but she was also a successful and industrious businesswoman, and also a keen preserver of some of England's most beautiful landscapes. These books are the definition of whimsy. They are about these forest animals, whether it's a rabbit or a hedgehog or two mice that live in a little doll's house, who have adventures. Sometimes they have morals to the story. Sometimes they're simply a delight in the small things. They're absolutely the epitome of whimsy. And the fact that her two legacies were, on the one hand, these beautiful, delightful children's books, and on the other hand, the preservation of land, I don't think are unconnected facts. I think that Beatrix Potter's delight in, cherishment of, and attention to the beauty of the landscapes that she painted became the motivating factor to protect the landscapes that she loved. Once again, we see that whimsy can both help us see and appreciate the beauty and importance of goodness and to become defenders of it. The music we're listening to underneath this right now comes from the film Miss Potter, which is the thing that first kind of sparked my interest in Beatrix Potter. So take this as a double recommendation, both to go look over Beatrix Potter's legacy, but also to go watch Miss Potter, which is a beautiful film. Now, Beatrix Potter was raised in a wealthy family, but she was fairly isolated. From the time she was a little girl, she had a governess, and she wasn't really friends with many other children. So, not having many friends, she spent her days drawing and painting, and her family often spent long, luxurious vacations in kind of remote areas. So, she spent a lot of time in the Lake District and in Scotland, and being sort of lonely, and she had kind of a strained relationship with her mother, and her father loved her very much, but didn't know exactly how to relate to her as a girl. She would spend hours and hours painting the flora and fauna and wildlife of the beautiful places she lived. Now, after having not gotten married, well into her 30s, and being kind of looked upon with a bit of suspicion by her family because she kind of wasn't of much use to them, because she hadn't gotten married and she wasn't particularly a socialite, she did something very surprising. She self-published Peter Rabbit. Now, after it had some success, a publisher picked it up and did a printing edition. And after the first year, it sold 56,470 books, which is wild. Now, even in today's standards, that's a best-selling book. But back then, when A, there weren't as many people because the population was down, and also this was sort of this wasn't a normal book. This wasn't your normal trade book or a book of philosophy or a novel. It was to children. But Beatrix's attention to detail and her vivid imagination created a book that would become a classic. And she really wielded her influence powerfully. She was an adept businesswoman, and she saved her money. She did a great job. That's something I think that she's often not known for, is how well she stewarded her wealth, and also how well she managed kind of the image and ethos of the books that she created. And a part of that was how well she kind of managed her legacy and what she wanted the legacy of her books to be about. So while they would suggest kind of certain types of books or bindings or whatever to her, she said, no, I want these books to be small, and I want them to have beautiful covers, and I want the ink to be as expensive as possible so they can see the illustrations, because I want to make a book that children will absolutely love. And so she did, and she was wildly successful. Now, once she had saved up all of her money, she did another shocking thing, and she got married to someone in her 50s, and she also bought herself Hilltop Farm, which is in the Lake District. I've had the pleasure of visiting it twice, once in absolutely pouring, ridiculous rain with my mother and sister and my dear, she's sort of a grandmother to me, mentor Phyllis. We went up there and had a wonderful time in dripping rain and then had tea time there. And then another time with my best friend Elena. We ended up taking a long hike through a very sunny day, and we took the wrong direction, so we actually ended up tromping through fields and climbing over fences and getting caught in cobwebs, which I'm sure that Beatrix Potter would have very much endorsed. But she bought herself this beautiful Hilltop Farm, which she was kind of her haven. And it was also a place for her to get away from her mother, because she had an okay relationship with her mother, but it was always a little bit strained. So this was kind of her place. And while she was up there in the Lake District, the place that she had first learned to love the flora and fauna and little animals that she painted for these children, she became kind of the disciple of a man named Hardwick Ronsley, who was an Anglican priest, a poet, and a hymn writer, and a preservationist. So this was kind of at the time when you had the Industrial Revolution had already started and it polluted many of the English cities. And there was this fear that the Lake District would be a place that would be developed and that it would become kind of a center of commercialism. And Ronsley was passionate that that should not happen. So he kind of talked to Beatrix Potter about this, and she became really passionate about it as well, because these places, the Lake District and the Highlands, they were spaces where she'd learned to love the beauty that she painted and passed on to children to begin with. And so the thought of it being developed or being polluted with industrialization really horrified her. So over her lifetime, she used her wealth to buy up farms that were going to fail. And so she was afraid that they would fail and then sell to developers. She would buy up those farms and fund them to keep going as working farms. And then she also just bought land. So by the time of her death, she had purchased 4,000 acres of land and 14 working farms, which she gave to what is now known as the National Trust. And those farms, those 14 farms, are still working farms today. When I went to the Lake District, it is probably one of the most beautiful places I've ever seen in my life. I put in some pictures in the show notes. If you go to joyclarkson.com, you can see them. It is breathtaking. And I love that her legacy that she left behind were these beautiful children's books, but also that she left behind a legacy of preserved beauty, of land that remains untouched today. And the reason I'm talking to you about Beatrix Potter is because I think that her work and her life make an interesting point. Now, on a facade level, you could say, well, she made some nice, cute little books for children, and they were beautiful, and compared to some of the ugly children's books today, they're valuable, and that is true. But I think that it's deeper than that. I think that the care and attention and value she put in creating these worlds and noticing the animals and the flora and fauna, the beautiful flowers that were native to the places she loved, were reflected in her passion to preserve the Lake District. Those things were connected. So when we talk about whimsy, you know, as this thing that focuses on the small and the strange, that treats things lightly, and in doing so helps us see the beauty and value of things, this is so evident in Beatrix Potter's life. She valued the Lake District so much that she painted it beautifully and whimsically, and that passion led her to be a protector of that place. This was no shallow whimsy. This whimsy was both good art, as it has delighted and entertained children for years and years, while also bringing them to notice the beauty of nature and the beauty of the specific place that she loved. But it's also good art for us, and it was obviously good art for her because it drove her to have a passion to protect and preserve the places that she painted. Now, I wish that I could sit down with Beatrix Potter today and interview her about what she thinks the wisdom of whimsy is, because I think she would have articulate and wonderful things to say. But in her place, I have someone else who reminds me very much of her, and her name is Breezy Brookshire. Breezy is an illustrator. She's an internet friend. I've never met her in real life, but we've had many interactions, and I've always enjoyed our conversations. And she does beautiful children's illustrations. You should go on my show notes, and you could see some of the loveliest ones. I had her send me in. I asked her, what reminds you of whimsy in your own illustrations? She sent me this beautiful image, I believe called the Book Tree, which depicts kind of these imaginary worlds and everyone roaming and reading, and it's so beautiful. And the attention that Breezy shows to detail, to kind of this dreamy atmosphere, to opening up children's minds to imagination, to delight, and to hope, reminds me of Beatrix Potter. So I thought that I would take just a moment to, first of all, bring Breezy's art to your mind, because I really believe in supporting good artists, and I'm always waiting for Breezy to have her first New York Times bestsellers, because I really think she's that talented. But also to be able to ask her, as a working artist, what she thinks the value of whimsy is, and if it is something that has the capacity to make us better people. So I asked her, what do you think the value of beauty and of whimsy is? And this is what she said. Beauty reminds me that there is something greater beyond what's right in front of me. Beauty and whimsy lighten our hearts and help us dream. It could be anything. A painting of a sunlit cottage, a ballad about a knight fighting a dragon, a postcard with a whimsical bird on it. It reminds me that my current situation isn't the end of my story, or the point of my existence. The God still has good for me. It tells me that the universe is a dance designed by a loving God. We become jaded easily and need to know that even when things seem dark and endlessly difficult, there is still joy to be had. I just thought this paragraph from Breezy was absolutely beautiful and gets to the heart of what we've been talking about, that whimsy, things that are beautiful, things that are light, things that don't necessarily represent the tridium, as we talked about earlier, the death and resurrection of Easter, those things can still be great testaments to us of the wonder, the strangeness, and the beauty of life, that they awaken in us a sense of the value and goodness of dear things. When we hold things lightly, when we look at them upside down, and when we enjoy, we begin to see the true gravity of simple life and how worthwhile it is to defend it, just like Beatrix Potter defended the beauty of the things that she loved to paint. So far in our investigation of the wisdom of whimsy, we have met an author who emerged from his own morbidity by experiencing the strangeness of life, who helped others see the world upside down so they might see the world's value when it was right side up, and who used that topsy-turvy point of view to shape a philosophy and a politics that was based around hope and around a vision of the good rather than around cynicism. Then we've gotten to look at an artist whose intense love of her childhood landscapes led to both great artistry and also great preservation. And finally, we're going to end with one of my favorite musical artists, someone who shows us how to hold the heavy and the light together. Ever there was an artist that was whimsical, it is Regina Spektor. In history, training, or talent, there was no one quite like her. She was born in Moscow in 1980 to a Jewish family, and when she was 9 years old, she immigrated to America. Deprived of her beloved piano, she would practice on tabletops and any flat surface that reminded her of a piano. Eventually, her father found Sonia Vargas from the Manhattan School of Music, whom she studied with until she was 17. Eventually, she went on to complete a composition program at the Conservatory of Music at Purchase College, and all of this was in classical music. She really began to shine, though, when she combined her classical music with her compelling lyrics and playful style, and perhaps most wonderful of all, her habit of using her voice like an instrument. They went to watch each other. Oh, friends, it would be hard to express how much I love Regina Spektor. I think she was the first musical artist that I could really call my own. Growing up, I would often kind of get things from my older siblings or my parents, but Regina Spektor was mine all the way through. I think what I loved about her was this combination of the way that she could deal with the heavy and the light. She would go from writing something like Eat that plays with all these funny little nonsense words that aren't real words that rhyme with other things, to then going and writing a song like Laughing with God, where she talks about how all of us, even those of us who doubt and doubt if God exists, when we come to moments of sorrow or of trial, wish for something beyond us and find ourselves praying. I think I also just loved how she could capture an emotion so succinctly. There's this wonderful song by her called Two Birds in a Wire, and you could tell that it's kind of about this relationship where two people want two different things, but they're waiting for the other person to hop off the wire. But the way she does it is so comical and humorous that you kind of laugh because you know how it feels. You know how it feels to be in a relationship that you need to leave, but feel like you shouldn't. It's almost like by treating these things lightly, by describing a relationship as two birds in a wire, a failing relationship, she makes it easier to get at the truth of it. Just like G.K. Chesterton, and even like Beatrix Potter, she treats things lightly so that we can understand them heavily. And that really, to me, gets at some of the criticism that we talked about in the opening, you know, with this theologian who said that good art must be dark. And I think that oftentimes people talk about whimsical art as though it's kind of unmeaningful or only people with easy lives could write it. But Regina Spektor has not had an easy life. Her earliest years were years in which her parents were overlooked and depressed in a country that didn't really want them there. And many of Regina's other songs show this real depth and ability to experience sorrow. So her whimsy seems not to come out of a denial of that, but to be a way of learning how to look at the world, learning how to cope with it. And I think that she truly understands the wisdom of whimsy, the ability to look at the small, the strange, and the humorous, and the ways that those things can help reorient us to kind of the absurdity of life. And reckoning with those strangenesses and those absurdities don't necessarily make us nihilists. They make us learn to love and appreciate the small goodness that we see, because the closer we look at it, the more we find that it is valuable. Just like G.K. Chesterton looked at the red hair on the girl, or just like Beatrix Potter looked closely at the flora and fauna and saw that it was worth celebrating. And there's one song in particular, though there are many that I could pick, that I think that really demonstrates this kind of aspect of Regina's artistry, the way that she treats things lightly so that we can understand them heavily. And that is the song On the Radio. Now let me take a moment to say that I have made a Spotify playlist of some of my favorite songs by Regina Spektor. Truly, she is one of my top five. If I had to pick five artists I had to listen to the rest of my life, she'd be one of them. And I always used to say that she was my spirit animal, because there's something about her that's just both deep and whimsical, both delightful and sorrowful. And if I could hold all of those things in myself, I would feel like I was a well-rounded person. And that, to me, is what she does really well. She holds together both the profound, the difficult, the ugly, with the light and the delightful and the humorous. And she teaches us to reckon with the holistic element of life. I think that's what bothered me most about the criticism of art that was humorous or whimsical. It's the idea that all of life is heavy and sad, when the reality is that it's not. Life is hard and it is difficult, but there are still nachos and loved ones and puppy dogs. And to have a full view of reality and to come to truth, we have to reckon with the strangeness of holding all of those things together. And like I said, I think a song that does that really well in her work is the song On the Radio. So the song begins in this kind of silly, absurd way, where she begins with just kind of rhyming everything she can think of. It starts with, "This is how it works." Now, I think that line is really important, because I think the whole song is kind of trying to explain life, explain how we can hold the difficult and the light together. So she says, "This is how it works. It feels a little worse than when we drove our hearse right through that screaming crowd while lapping up a storm until we were just born, until it got so warm that none of us could sleep." She goes on and on like this, and she kind of rhymes these things, and it's kind of this little silly kind of narrative of all these strange little things. So the whole first verse is like that. It is the epitome of whimsical. It's things that are supposed to make you giggle, things that don't seem quite to stick together, and things that you're supposed to laugh at. But then we get into the second verse. And in the same way that she opens up with, "This is how it works," and then she tells this kind of absurd story where everything just rhymes, then you have this serious, kind of heavier verse. And this is what it says. "This is how it works. You're young until you're not. You love until you don't. You try until you can't. You laugh until you cry. You cry until you laugh. And everyone must breathe until their dying breath. No, this is how it works. You peer inside yourself. You take the things you like, then try to love the things you took. And then you take the love you made and stick it into someone else's heart, pumping someone else's blood. And walking arm in arm, you hope you don't get harmed. But even if you do, you'll just do it all again." To me, I know almost no song or poem that so succinctly describes the feeling of what it is to be human. The absurdity, the profundity, the strangeness. To me, what Regina Spektor is doing in this song is what G.K. Chesterton talks about in that chapter on fairy tales. Remember when he says that we made the river run with wine so we might remember that it runs with water and be refreshed and reminded by it? And to me, what she's doing is she's reminding us of the rules of life, that it is small and strange and difficult and absurd and profound. But by kind of turning us on our heads, we begin to see the fragility of this life as something good. Something we can say yes to, something worth living for. The whimsical element of her music helps her be able to say these very kind of profound and blunt and almost sad things with this real candor and straightforwardness. Sometimes I think that in all of our profound meanderings, and trust me, as a PhD, I meander, I hope, profoundly often, I think sometimes we lose track of those most simple and true things in our lives. that we take the love inside us and hope to love somebody else, but that love is vulnerable. And Regina Spektor, with her playfulness, kind of holds things lightly so that we can see them truly. And that, I think, is a profound and important thing. Surely we can say that her art is good. It's good, firstly, because by treating things lightly, by turning them on their head, by making us laugh, we take down our defenses and we reckon with what reality truly is, strange and impermeably meaningful. But it also is good for us. As we allow ourselves to be stirred, we begin to love the goodness and the strangeness of life. And when we love it, we become defenders of it. And that, I think, is truly the wisdom of whimsy, that it helps us recognize the intrinsic goodness, humor, delight of life. And that as we recognize the strangeness of life, we become attached to it, and it energizes us to protect that goodness. All of the artists we have looked at today are artists who focus on humor, on small things, on delight and laughter. But all of them, both in their art and in their personal lives, are great advocates for goodness, for justice, and for preservation. And I think that that flows out of their appreciation of the small, out of their imagination that allows them to see the significance of things that may seem insignificant to the wise. It reminds me of the verse in 1 Corinthians where he says, "We are fools for Christ." In the foolishness of these artists, they can see the profundity of little things, and it makes them better defenders of it than almost anyone else. I want to end today by playing Regina Spektor's beautiful song on the radio. But before I do that, I want to tell you what I hope that you take away from this episode. That whimsy helps us recognize the intrinsic goodness of life, and that energizes us to protect that goodness. And in that way, truly, whimsy must be wise.